You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
Well, today's podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain management made simple. It is the easiest and quickest way to buy a domain name. Hover is honest. It never tries to upsell you at checkout. Everything the other guys extra charge for is included in the cost of your domain, like who is privacy and domain forwarding. And plus, Hover has the best customer support in the industry. They have a no-hold phone policy. That means if you run into a problem, you call Hover and a real live human being answers the phone, ladies and gentlemen. I actually get excited. It's just so rare, right? So basically, it takes the hassle out of getting a domain. That is what they are selling. You just type in a few keywords you want in the search box and it'll tell you what's available. And the cool thing is they specialize in .net. So a lot of times you want something in .com or .org. It's not available. Try .net. That is their specialty. And Hover has valet transfers. What does that mean? Well, if you've got a domain somewhere else, they'll take care of the whole process of moving the domain to Hover for you. So they specialize in .NET and they now offer Google Apps. You can get Gmail, Calendar, Drive, Docs, the whole package. You got 25 gigabytes of storage. And, you know, Google's a huge company, let's be honest. Hard to get a hold of a real person, I'm sure. But Hover has a human being that specializes in Google Apps. So, if you got a business, you got a family, you got a group, you want the ability to share all kinds of stuff with, try Hover.com. See how it works. They'll give you a 30-day free trial with the Google Apps as well. So, you know, see what you think. And the best part, guess what? If you go to Hover.com/Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, well, that's a promo code that gets you 10% off a new domain name. Oh, man, the power I have to get you 10% off. We got Jack O'Brien, the editor-in-chief of Cracked.com, and wrote a book, which I loved. It's such an easy book, man. It's such a fun, easy book to read. It's called the D-Text Book.
Yeah, and it, I mean, you know, this is a bizarre-ass compliment, but it is a great bathroom book.
We've heard that more than once, actually.
Well, you just basically take on every myth that we grow up thinking. Like, I thought, like, the fact that we shouldn't shower as much was kind of interesting, because I've been reading a lot about how bacteria is a very important, you know, the medical forefront, new frontier of medical science. A lot of people are working on how to sort of manage bacterial populations on the human body and in the human body. And
yeah, you've got this whole invisible ecology just like surrounding your body and inside of your body, and you don't want to push it too far one way or the other. You don't want to, you know, do a blitzkrieg on it and shower every day, all day.
Thank you for the World War II reference.
Yeah.
Jack O'Brien doesn't play around. He's not worried about dropping a reference from 1941, ladies and gentlemen.
There'll be more to come.
But you're right, right? I mean, that's kind of the science. So we shouldn't be showering with antibacterial soap and screwing up the fauna of our skin, basically.
Right. We have a whole section of the book that's just sort of a handbook to your body and things that you're doing wrong, where we reveal, yeah, we're bathing incorrectly in the sense that we shouldn't be bathing every day and, you know, scouring our skin off. And,
yeah.
You know.
Those things are, like, I'm thinking about making a video for my son, who's only two, because in case I die, I want him to know things I didn't know. Like, little things. Like, I don't know.
Brian, how much do you think
tongue
about your own death?
I live on the edge, man. I live on the edge. I live on the edge. Now that I got the D-Text book, I can stay safer. But, yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, and a lot of things that I didn't know, just about basic hygiene, like brush your tongue or don't brush too hard and all those things that actually do make a difference in your
yeah,
quality of life.
Or that you're pooping incorrectly.
I know.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
Who knew? That was one that, I mean, there's no real practical way to change this, but apparently we're supposed to be pooping in the position that
squat
a catcher assumes.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I grew up all over the world. In most of the developing world, shits in a hole, okay?
Right.
If you got a shit in a hole, that's exactly how you do it. And my buddy, who used to live in my garage, who's a real mountain man, kind of one of these, like, you know, I eat only raw food. And he took to squatting on my toilet until he missed. And my girl was like, and he forgot. And my girl was, there's shit all over your toilet. I was like, I literally called him out. Get back here, clean it up right now. But, you know, I guess he was right at the end of the day.
No. We have a page that says specifically not to miss the toilet and to shit into the toilet. So.
And another reason the detox book is important.
Have you seen that people now have like add-ons for Western toilets so that you can squat shit in them? There's like a special like stand you can put around it.
Who invents that shit? That's crazy.
People who are really into paleo.
How much research did you really do on this, Jack? Like, well, I mean, you know, I believe that all of it is pretty much, you know, you guys did a lot of research, but how much, where'd you get all your source material?
Sure. So we actually have been, this is compiled from a bunch of different facts that we've covered on the site, as well as some new ones that we came across while kind of doing additional research into those facts. So it was like over the course of, you know, 6 years of publishing these myth-busting articles and just kind of coming to the conclusion that everything that we learned in our textbooks was kind of aimed to make the world seem more boring than it actually is. Hmm. So we thought that kind of creating a grade school, middle school, high school style textbook that we could put all of these facts into and kind of use the illustrations and charts and stuff that we all got bored by in school. You use their format against them and kind of pack all of this fascinating information into a textbook that kind of undoes the damage of the textbooks that our teachers use to control us.
That's a strong word, control. I like that.
Well, Hunter wrote a book called The Straight A Conspiracy, which was really basically a rebuttal to our education system, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great, great Woodrow Wilson quote. Woodrow Wilson, before he was the president of the United States, he went and spoke to the National Conference of High School Teachers or whatever. And he said, what we want is we want an educational system that produces two kinds of people. One that has the benefits of a liberal arts education and is capable of, you know, free thought and all that sort of stuff. And a much larger class that is so turned off and so dull that they are only suited to the most menial kinds of manual labor. Hmm. And, I mean, that's what our educational system produces.
Yeah.
It produces a tiny people, a group of people who are intellectually alive, and a much larger group of people who are so switched off to thinking because the whole process seems so boring and so uninteresting that they end up just doing manual labor to support themselves.
See, that's interesting because my experience with conspiracies is always that they're never as smart or impressive as that.
That's for sure, by the way. Nobody's that organized.
Well,
right?
My
assumption was that my teachers taught me this bullshit because they're like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. You know, they're just like trying to get through to retirement. They just want a piece of little peace and quiet, and it's much easier to, you know, teach a room full of children who are on the verge of falling asleep than it is kids who are just like vibrating with energy because they can't believe how amazing the true story of World War II is.
Yeah.
Really bringing it back to World War II, guys.
Specifically 1941.
Yeah. Thank you, Jack O'Brien.
The reason why we called this Straight A Conspiracy is it's actually came out of a conversation that we had with Stan Rogo, who is the executive producer of Lizzie McGuire, the kids show. And, you know, the problem that we had is we'd done all this research into the neuroscience and the psychology and all of that sort of stuff. And we're like, now we have to figure out how to get a kid to actually listen to this. And he said, listen, I've spent my entire career writing stuff for teenagers. And teenagers do not want to hear that they're amazing and they can do anything if they just put their minds to it. The one thing they want to hear is, because they feel like their life sucks, they're willing to hear that they've been lied to. And so that was the whole premise of the book.
So you manipulated the children into reading your book.
That's right.
Whatever works, though, man. I mean, this is what I appreciate about the D textbook is just exactly that. You're kind of, there are a lot of, the theme of the book really feels like you're basically saying, look, there are a lot of things to be excited about. My teachers were basically beaten down. They probably came in there with good intentions, and they had some idealistic notion that they could, you know, make a difference. And when you're teaching 30, 40 kids, you know, it's very difficult. You know?
And it's also the way that the information is structured. I mean, James Loewen, who wrote Lies My Teacher Told Me, which is an awesome, awesome, awesome book, basically raises the central problem, which is if you want to sell an American history textbook in the United States, you have to get it approved by the two largest markets, which are California and Texas.
Right.
And the problem is that what a Texas parent thinks should be in a history textbook is not what a California parent thinks should be in a history textbook.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that there's no story in the history textbook, and you just end up with the driest, most boring, uncontroversial facts.
That's interesting.
And that's the way that our history textbooks are structured. And so all of the fun, weird stuff is taken out, and all of the stuff that says, you know, this is why a person would do this, these were her as actual motivations or anything like that, is just gone.
Jack, what would you do, Jack, to kind of change the education system?
Oh man,
deal with that question.
I mean, we kind of brushed past the conspiracy is just comparing your teachers to Danny Glover and Lethal Weapon. That was our big answer to the educational problem, and then we just get on to the facts. Because, I mean, but seriously, though, the thing that we found and the reason that we felt really compelled and passionate about making this book is that the facts, like, but that they were kind of covering up, or that the lies were covering up, are way more interesting than the stuff that you learned. And so we just wanted to kind of, I mean, that's kind of what the D-Text book focuses on, is just all these more interesting truths that are hiding behind sort of the boring dates and numbers and kind of simple versions of history that we get.
Right. And you got some really fascinating, like, I think some of the stuff is really, like, Einstein was a philanderer. How awesome is that? Einstein was banging girls, like, just married twice, but just probably, there were so many physics sort of junkies or groupies or roadies that
he was
probably
a rock star, man.
Exactly.
He was the rock star of his time. Like, he not only had he, like, changed our conception of the universe, but he had, pretty much helped us end World War II.
Bring it back.
Yeah. but he did.
It was a big war, guys. I mean,
don't be fooled by the fact that it's World War II. It's actually...
He was Luke Skywalker. He helped us win Star Wars, you know? And
He's
going to just have women throwing themselves at him. And the thing that I admire about it is that he was not... duplicitous about it. He told his wife right up front that this is how it's going to be. You should expect me to have other women. And
yeah,
you know.
And by the way, when you're the smartest man in the world, you get a pass. How about that? And I'll do you one better. He should have been breeding with everybody. I want that gene pool out there. He should have been on a sex tour throughout the entire world to make the race smarter. Get more of that Einstein sperm and more women. I'm sorry.
That's how you fix the education.
Yeah, exactly. There's a movie that I want to see, the Albert Einstein sex tour.
Exactly. But it's true, man. I mean, you think about what a complete rock star he was. I mean, I think, you know, he probably showed more restraint than certainly I would have. Talk a little bit about Thomas Edison, man. You guys have a pretty strong, you know, Thomas Edison was a thieving dunce.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Because I know Tesla. On Edison.
Yeah, I know Tesla didn't get his due. So.
Yeah, Tesla obviously had some great ideas about electricity. The version of electricity that we're using today was the one that Tesla was fighting for. The version of electricity that Edison was fighting for is not in use anymore. But in order to prove his point, Edison electrocuted an elephant in a public display of how dangerous our modern form of electricity was. So this guy who we put on the names of our schools and our power companies actually held back the progress of electricity by a number of decades.
And because of, I've seen that footage actually of an elephant being
Topsy.
It's awful.
Yeah. Topsy the elephant.
But because he basically was preaching, he basically thought electricity was a dangerous thing.
Well, no, there was what he's talking about is AC, right, is what Tesla did, and DC is what
Edison
did. Yeah, and okay. You know, it's not just an Australian rock band. AC and DC are two electrical
alternating
current and direct current.
So okay. Edison had like kind of put all of his investments into direct current, and here comes this guy Tesla, who's a mad genius with alternating currents, and it's a superior product, and he knows this. But what Edison was great at, and the reason that his name is on our schools, is that he was really good at PR, and so he waged this highly public battle against alternating current, even though it was like clearly superior, and eventually lost it, but not before electrocuting an elephant and kind of ruining Tesla's
and
career.
Inventing the electric chair. I mean, you know, that was part of how he tried to discredit AC. Was he basically was trying to show how dangerous it was, so he was like, see, it can kill a person.
Damn.
And he, like, you know, electrocuted. He had this guy that he hired as a flunky who he had electrocute all of these animals. It was super, super screwed up. And just to give context on how much better AC is than DC, if you had a DC electrical system, you would have to have a power station every few blocks.
Right.
As opposed to a big centralized power station outside the city, which is obviously a million times more efficient.
Thank you, Tesla. Thank you, Nikola Tesla.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Edison, like, when he wasn't kind of stealing, like, he was good at taking other people's inventions and finding ways to improve on them, which is, like, how he ended up getting credit for the light bulb. But some of the inventions we cover that were his own ideas were, like, he had a ghost-busting device.
Wow.
Where he used the device pulled something out of the air that he called immortal units, and captured it. Was basically the little trap from Ghostbusters, except in our world where ghosts don't fly around. So actually just a crazy guy walking around with a metal box.
Amazing.
Some of the stories about, I mean, firstly, just to put it in context as well, you know, we hear that Edison had 1,000 patents. Edison didn't have 1,000 patents. His workers had 1,000 patents, but of course he wanted that intellectual property, so he puts his name on it. But the story that we get is like this man sitting in a room alone coming up with 1,000 patents. It's utterly retarded.
Yeah, Jack, you say something interesting in the book too, and I can't remember where it was, but I got to thinking about it. You know, really, people that go down in history were people who were really good at their own PR. I mean, you know, they were just really good at kind of staying in the limelight. I mean, you know, Hitler and his rehearsal in a mirror and having people take pictures of the different kinds of, you know, holding his hands up. And I as an actor, and a very fine one, I might add, Jack.
He's really
one
good.
One of the best.
Thank you.
Have you seen his Hamlet?
Nobody else has either, but you should see me in the mirror. But you know, I would watch those theatrical speeches and I could tell, I was like, this dude has rehearsed this. There's no way that's just, you know, he's obviously been watching himself in a mirror, you know, and it just feels like, and which doesn't surprise me. Oh my God, Hitler was a narcissist? No way.
I do think though that the perception by non-actors who haven't who, like, I think the thing you hear is his passionate speech making made, like, allowed him to storm to power, and you see those videos, and I think the average assumption is here's a guy who was like really passionate about what he was doing, and so just seeing images of him like really hamming it up for the camera that's one of my favorite pictures that we have in the book. Is there's this photograph that so Hitler had a personal photographer. You're right, he was great at PR, he rehearsed everything right before he did it until he got it exactly right. And there are these pictures of him like in his dressing room, just like really going over the top with these gestures. I think a few of these are gestures that he decided were maybe a little bit too much, but they're just so ridiculous. It's like Hitler playing Hitler in a like vaudeville play or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. But these are important things to know.
Absolutely.
I mean, sometimes the PR didn't, it wasn't like a calculated thing. Paul Revere, the reason that we get his name, on our elementary schools is because it rhymed with the thing that a poet at the time of the Civil War was trying to rhyme it with.
Longfellow.
Midnight Clear. Yeah. Longfellow. So Paul Revere was one of 40 messengers that night who had to kind of go out and quietly. Nobody was yelling, "The British are coming, the British are coming," because 20% of the population at that time were still loyalists. So you're not
that's for sure.
Running down the middle of the street going. So he was one of 40 people who were charged with kind of riding as fast as they could, quietly telling the people who were sympathetic to their case. He was also one of a handful who was caught that night by the British. So he was the worst of he was one of the worst of the 40. And we remember him because his name
rhymes.
Fit nicely into the poem. And mm-hmm. the guy who was the best at it, I forget what his name was, but it was like Pendergrast or something that's really hard to rhyme with.
Yeah. Right.
Well, his name was Orange.
Exactly.
I just think that, you know, the value of all this sort of a book like this is also the fact that you've got to be, when you hear something, and it is given to you from an authority. The tendency would be, for example, the Mongols killed 70 million people. Well, I don't know. That you've got to, when you hear a large number
and
you hear anything like that, you've got to stop for a second, and nobody does this. No one does this shit, but you've got to stop for a second and go, wait a minute. Where'd you get that number? Who told you that, and how did they get that number? And it's like this game of telephone, especially with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have to be the internet. I mean, this book is basically a rebuttal to everything that happened before the internet.
But there's that's what's so interesting about this. I mean, you referenced, in terms of the marketing,
mm-hmm.
the whole idea that people are born smart or that there are these amazing figures in history comes from that marketing. Take the work of thousands of people and you pretend like it's yours. And over time, like the idea that Edison invented the light bulb, back when he invented the light bulb, in inverted commas, would have been ridiculous because the light bulb was invented 45 years before Edison was even born. And so you never would have been able to pull that lie off back then. But now, because we don't know anything about the history,
it's just easier.
It's easier. Exactly. Yeah. But so, and that's how these myths...
Easier until Jack O'Brien came along.
That's right. And he cracked
it.
That's
where I come in.
Yeah, exactly. 1941.
Ladies and gentlemen. one of my favorite parts of the book is the book on practical physics. This shit, I can't get enough of this, especially the truth about guns.
Yeah.
And you're not surviving a fall from six stories high. That's not going to happen, right? You're basically...
Yeah, I had always assumed that I could just jump off the top of at least a 5-story building, maybe not 6, but
yeah.
5 definitely, into a dumpster, because I've seen it happen in... every movie,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Every action movie. I don't watch any other kind of movie, so maybe there are movies where people don't jump off the top of buildings. And
maybe dumpsters. I don't watch them.
Never heard of them.
They're for pussies.
But apparently, that is only good for keeping all of your body parts in one convenient location for them to be picked up by the coroner, because you don't survive that. Like your body, the human body, cannot survive moving at a certain speed and then stopping suddenly. It's not, that's why water can be just extremely deadly at certain heights. And that's why it doesn't matter what you jump into off the top of a building. You're not
going to
be
happening,
cool.
Unless it's a huge airbag. But
right.
I mean, it's, and by the way, when you do that, you got to land the right way. I got enough friends who are stuntmen who do high falls. You better land the right way. Cause if you don't land the right way, you'll go right through the airbag.
Oh God.
Right.
Yeah.
Things that gradually slow you down like a bungee cord or one of the huge airbags that's built for that purpose,
exactly.
You can be fine, but those usually aren't waiting at the bottom of the building when you're being chased by a bad guy.
I jumped off a 35-foot cliff, and let me tell you, man, it you better be wearing shoes and you better cover your balls. It sucks.
Into water.
Yeah, into water. It's not fun. It's not
fun. Yeah, no, that is...
But
I used to jump off bridges as a kid because I was a stupid kid. It was very painful.
It is painful.
But I sometimes
water
jump out of my
of your
bed.
Head that you didn't know could contain water.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the surface tension of the water, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
right.
Kind of the problem. I love the everything you believe about guns is wrong, and the explosion shockwaves will tear you apart like wet tissue paper of a missile or something like that. And you got, I mean, and it's crazy, right? I mean,
yeah, the Mission Impossible. I think every Mission Impossible is contractually obligated to contain a scene with Tom Cruise surfing on a explosion shockwave, like strong gust of wind, right?
Well, that's Scientology.
Yeah, I mean, he can, obviously.
I was going to say, you haven't read
Are you clear, man?
L. Ron Hubbard's, yeah. If you were clear, you fucking loser.
Yeah, exactly. You could ride an explosion.
That book is amazing. Did you read that Lawrence Frank book?
Yes, I did, Lawrence Wright. Yes, I did, Going Clear.
Yeah, Lawrence Wright. Frank, not the NBA coach. Although he has some interesting things to say about
yes,
it.
Yes, he does. He's in the revised version of Going Clear. Yeah, that's an amazing book.
Yeah, so you can't ride explosion shockwaves, and you will be turned into human pudding if you try to do that. Because the thing that, like explosions, it's not the ball of fire that is harmful. It's that there's this concussive wave. It's like a huge, almost sound wave that can be invisible to the naked eye, and that's what does the damage. And it's not something you can surf on. It's something that it's what kills people when there's an explosion, right?
Right.
And
right.
With guns, I get one of the most practical. This is one of those myths where I was like, wow, that learning this probably will save my life at some point. Because I mean, I've only been in a handful of gunfights in my life. But
that's it, dude. Come on, man. Anyway, Jack O'Brien.
That's how Brian and I warm up for an episode. Is just with a gunfight.
Yeah,
so, you know.
Shit.
It's a close quarters fire.
Yeah, exactly.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite line in the podcast ever. Maybe I've only been in a handful of gunfights.
But I had always assumed. So when a gun is dropping in a movie, the thing that you want to avoid is having the gun hit the ground, right? Because then it's going to go off.
Exactly.
Because all guns go off the second they hit the ground.
Right.
And so I would have tried to grab it. Mm-hmm. And that is apparently the best way to shoot yourself.
That's right.
In
That's
a horrible
right.
place. And the thing that people who use guns more than me tell you to do when you drop a gun is just let it fall. Because mm-hmm. guns have been designed since the 1960s, and this was smart of gun makers, to not go off when they hit the ground. And that's like a law.
Right.
If your gun can't be dropped from 20 feet up and not go off, then your gun cannot be sold.
Well, that's good for me because what I like to do dramatically is even when I got a full chamber, I like to drop my guns and pull out my nunchaku. I call them nunchaku. A lot of guys, you guys know them as nunchucks, but and I just, or my throwing stars. But
Brian,
right.
This is,
you or know. You're like throwing a gun or catching a gun from your homie. In
there
the
is
gun
that.
Tower,
there
right?
is that. Where I go, like that, and it just takes one whistle, and a gun just magically flies through the air and in my hand.
But this wouldn't apply to a German Luger from say 1941.
No, those you need to grab.
Would those guns? Is there a chance that a Luger or something, if it falls, an older gun falls, it'll go off?
I think we found that the law was made in the 60s or 70s. So yeah, probably it was that law was probably put in place because people were finding themselves shot by guns that had fallen out of their...
And what don't you want to hide behind when you're in a gunfight?
Yeah, so we have this chart that is absurd bullshit you believe about gunfire, and we just have some myths, some mythical things that in movies are safe to hide behind in a gunfight, such as a couch. I've seen that in movies since we published this. A thin folding table and a wedding cake, I think, are all bullet stoppers.
Unless it's pound cake, right?
Yeah,
then?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Or
devil's food will stop bullets.
Devil's food cake.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, there's like bulletproof vests. You remember the scene in Back to the Future where Doc just gets where the
Just wasted by
the Libyans. Unload on him.
The Libyans just unload like an AK-47.
Yeah,
not happening.
And he's fine. And that apparently, it's not a magical force field. A bulletproof vest is, you're still getting hit by bullets. They're just not going into your body. But it's just sort of at that point, it's a convenient device for the mortician because it keeps your body parts.
That's right. I mean, what kills you? Yeah, a 9mm can be stopped by a Kevlar vest. And when the military uses Kevlar with ceramic.
Absolutely.
And that'll stop a larger round. But when you're talking about an assault rifle, like an AR-15 or an AK-47, good luck, man. It ain't stopping a deer rifle either. And also, like you said, the concussive force of that bullet is what stops your heart. Not mine, because I got a...
Right, your heart is unstoppable.
I'm just thickly muscled is really what it is. And I got a lot of heart, as they say in sports.
It's true. He actually has two of them.
Yeah,
he has a backup
muscular
one.
Heart. Yeah,
correct.
And the one that kind of ruined action movies for me—I mean, it didn't ruin—but the fact that an automatic assault rifle runs out of bullets in 3 seconds.
Isn't that crazy? You know what's funny about that is I shot one. I just went deer hunting in Wisconsin. Don't ask for a show called Meat Eater. And I shot an automatic rifle. I was with the SWAT team. They let me shoot an automatic an M4. And you're right, man. You run out of bullets in 3 seconds.
Yeah, that's a full clip.
Yeah, isn't it crazy?
Wow.
3 seconds.
Yeah. In movies, they run around for, you know, they run out of bullets when it is convenient for the plot.
And and even soldiers, from what, you know, I've talked to a lot of like soldiers, they don't put their guns on automatic. They put it on burst, which is like two shots at a time. You can be more accurate. When you got your gun on automatic, it's really hard to, not for me, but for a lot of guys.
Yeah.
Right. For most people who don't have supernatural aiming powers.
Thank you. I feel it. I shoot from my hip. I feel it.
And just for readers, you know, when you guys buy this book, just be clear that none of this applies to Brian Callen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I know this book is so up my alley, man. I can't get enough of
this
shit.
It's awesome.
It's all these things that we want to know that we've always wondered that you speculate on, and you can actually find out if there are people who have done the experiments.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you guys, information's out there. Not to sound too much like a X-Files conspiracy theory, I mean, we found it on the internet, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And then we cross-checked it with places that aren't famous for being full of lies.
Right. Well, what was the most surprising thing that you kind of found about, I mean, in researching all this stuff? I mean, what are the things, anything that kind of really blew your mind, besides the 3-second automatic gunfire thing?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that animals, I guess I had assumed that we learned about dinosaurs because dinosaurs were the coolest things ever and all our animals were stupid. You know, they teach you, like, the ostrich sticks its head in the sand because it doesn't understand how physics work, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's tries to hide by sticking its head in the sand. The ostrich is actually an awesome animal. It can run 60 miles per hour. It can bend its knees backward and disembowel you with 2,000 pounds of force. It's
good
like,
luck. Yeah. I call it the 350-pound kung fu turkey. Okay.
Yeah, but it's like a living dinosaur.
Yeah.
And we just kind of skip over that fact, and it's just that's the sort of thing that, I don't know. I feel like if I had learned that when I was a kid, I would have just been like on fire with like science curiosity. You know, I would have wanted to do nothing but like study animals. And instead they were like, yeah, there were these cool animals a billion years ago and they all died off.
And now we have
also,
all
those animals weren't that cool. Like, they now think the T-Rex was just covered in feathers and was
and a
like,
scavenger wasn't
and
even
a scavenger a, yeah. It just had really good sense of smell, which so they think that it just went around finding carrion to eat.
It's
and
crazy.
The invention of the color blue, that's in the intro. That was probably my I wrote the intro and I couldn't stop going on about that.
I thought that was interesting. Yeah, I thought what the conclusion of that was going to be that Homer was colorblind, and so then, but no, I guess color was not the colors were not as readily available because we didn't know how to dye things and mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Right. They just didn't have, like, the only things that were, so the idea is that when they went back and counted the references to color, there were like a bunch of mentions of black and white and red, like two mentions of green and yellow, and zero mentions of blue. And they counted that because they started noticing that he was really crappy at describing, like he described the sea as being the color of wine and the sky as the color of bronze. So they were like, wait, did our eyes change? Or because he's good at describing stuff, he's one of our greatest poets. And it turns out that when you go back in the history of a culture, colors always emerge in that pattern. Like, first, the people are aware of black and white and red, and then they become aware of green. Because
and red, red, because red, because it's the color of wine and blood, which is in...
Yeah.
Which is everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. You need to know about that no matter what. And blue is the one color that, I mean, you need to know that the sky is blue, but you don't need to really describe it as such because it's just the sky, right? It doesn't matter. And the same with the sea, right? And
right.
There was no practical use for the color blue, and so their eyes just didn't really perceive it until it became a concept. So it kind of changes the way you view history from this kind of rote series of names and dates to memorize to this kind of changing version of the world, and like that everybody is viewing the world through different eyes based on the culture that they live in.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like I just wish if they had just told me that before giving me all those books to read, I would have actually read them instead of, you know, bullshitting my way through the test.
Yeah.
But that's because it gives you a context for it, you know what I mean? So that it's not just a random fact, but it has meaning and it's connected to our experience and, you know, it all sort of fits into a larger picture that's full of interest.
Yeah, and that's kind of what the book tries to do is just give you a little more context that puts these things in a more interesting kind of framework.
What'd you study in school, and where'd you go?
Philosophy.
Ah, well. A great thing to study. We've had some great professors in philosophy, especially Dan Robinson over at Oxford and Georgetown, who has a course called this The Great Ideas of Philosophy.
So, I went to Georgetown. So
did you really?
I don't know him.
Dan Robinson, he taught at I guess he was
I think he's professor emeritus at Georgetown, and now he's like mostly at Oxford.
Yeah, mostly at Oxford it was. That's cool. I went to American University, which means you studied harder than I did in high school.
But went to the same bars.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
When did you graduate?
2003.
Dude, I graduated in 1989. Okay, this is outrageous.
So you were there for the good years.
I sure was.
Yeah.
I sure was for the good years. Well, talk a little bit about Native Americans and what you found. You know, we've had a couple of Charles Mann, some great historians on about this and sort of what the role of, and we're about to have Jared Diamond coming up here, but the role of plague and what germs.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Jared Diamond and the author of Lies My History Teacher Told Me.
James Lowen.
Yeah, James Lowen covered really well. And, you know, we mention James Lowen in the text of the book because our section on Native Americans is indebted to his work. But it's just basically the thing that you learn, right, is that they're kind of these people who, there were like roving packs of hippies who were like at peace with the earth and died off when we just kind of came in and like paved over their habitat. I feel like it's like just a very, very easy to dismiss. I mean, there's some mystery there, but you know, the main image that you get of them is fairly easy to dismiss, and there's just all these facts that make them so much more interesting. Like, first of all, our historical record starts, I mean, for all intents and purposes, like when the Pilgrims land, 96% of Massachusetts Native Americans had just been wiped out by a plague that came over with
96%.
96. So they weren't like settling in an untamed wilderness. It was more like New York City and I Am Legend, right? It's like a bunch of abandoned cities that they're moving into. They chose Plymouth Rock because Plymouth Rock had fields of planted corn already.
Wow.
Like it was just an abandoned city that was a thriving town, and they just kind of moved into that town and, you know, actually lived in the houses and used the plates and tools of a bunch of people who had just disappeared.
That's incredible. And I've heard that many times from reputable historians where, I mean, what you would hear is as they came in, they go, there's no one here. Mm-hmm. It looks like towns and no one is here. And it's hard to believe that they did suffer an apocalypse like that.
Well, and I mean, you know, I mean, David Grand talking about the lost city of Z. I mean, we had David Grand on, and the point is that, you know, people would wander through the Amazon and say, there's this massive civilization here, and that's where we get the idea of El Dorado. 50 years later, they walk through and they see nothing. Well, that's because the entire civilization was basically wiped out by a plague. Like,
it's
the
crazy,
society
man.
Had
it's
collapsed.
Pathogens and things like that.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what we're up against, you know? Think about being a Native American and literally, you know, what does that say about your God and everything, your whole history?
Your whole worldview.
Very demoralizing.
Yeah. I
mean, and it definitely changes the sort of cowboys and Indians narrative when you realize that they're not at full strength. These are like the stragglers from like
apocalypse.
A Mad Max style apocalypse.
Yeah.
You know, they're just the people who are left over and still grieving from the loss of most of their entire civilization. You know, all in, it killed 90% of this plague. It was, you know, a combination of smallpox and
influenza
rubella and
all that, yeah.
Yeah, all these different diseases that Europeans had developed an immunity to because they lived in such close quarters with livestock and other domesticated animals, which is kind of where these diseases come from. And so Europeans were just filthy.
But I wonder, has a biomedical, I mean, has somebody who specializes in infectious diseases, I mean, is it really possible, first of all, that these tribes had so much contact with each other? And isn't it possible, I feel like if people, like one tribe got smallpox or influenza or rubella or whatever it was, diphtheria, typhus, they would have died off very quickly in that area, and then, you know, the virus would have been contained, because most viruses and pathogens and bacterial, from what I understand, agents will usually infect a segment of the population, and then it'll divide exponentially, and then it'll die off.
Right. So that's what you would think based on the kind of image that we get of natives as being like a very, you know, the United States was mostly empty, is kind of how we think of it. And they were still living in the wilderness. But the truth is that they were, you know, a thriving society of up to 20 million people.
You're saying when we landed on Plymouth Rock?
No,
before
the apocalypse came through.
Right.
So when Columbus landed,
right.
Yeah,
that's
they
what
were.
Charles Mann said that some people are estimating that it's almost as high as 50, 60, 70 million people over, you know, I mean, spread out throughout the entire United States.
Yeah.
But I don't know
there
how
was
they
a
would
city in
that.
East St. Louis that was bigger than London in 1250. And it had suburbs and trade routes and stretched all the way, trade routes that went all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and they had this huge kind of pyramid thing that they built out of, like, they would take soil from all these different places in the Midwest and bring it here. And so the mound, it's called Monk's Mound, and it, like, has, it's different, it's, like, striped based on the soil that they brought in.
It's incredible.
It's, like, a really cool thing, and I think they're, like, building a parking lot on top of it right now. In St. Louis.
It was
this huge kind of thriving society, and that was, you know, they weren't passive. They didn't just, you know, they were so good at killing trees that there's a group of Stanford scientists who think that the reason, you know, about the Little Ice Age in Europe where it was like winter, it was basically what you see in Game of Thrones now, like winter for like five straight years.
God, I didn't know.
And they think that that might have happened because basically the plague killed off all the Native Americans. So the Native Americans were really like cut down a lot of trees and cleared a lot of wilderness with these like localized controlled burns. And so once they all died from this apocalypse, the trees grew back and you basically had reverse global warming. So, you know, what we're scared of happening when we cut all the trees down, the reverse happened and it was so cold, for like a decade that they call it the Little Ice Age. That's a theory from some college called Stanford. I'm not familiar with it.
some think tank. Yeah.
I believe that's where Jesse Spano wanted to go.
Exactly.
But the I mean, I think that's the thing. You know, we obviously talked to Charles C. Mann about that sort of narrative of the crying environmentally friendly Indian.
Right.
But you know, and that's the thing is,
first of all, they warred with each other.
Yeah.
Incessantly. You know,
were human.
And yeah, they were called human. They did everything we did.
That's the whole thing. Is that, you know, I think both sides are responsible for this. You know, the Native Americans definitely try and maintain a certain idea of, you know, there's this narrative of we were so peaceful and in touch with the land and all that sort of stuff, and then the evil white man came along. But I think it's much more interesting and much more fascinating to say, listen, these people endured a terrible apocalypse, you know, but they responded in the ways that humans would respond. You know, they tried to play the Europeans off against each other, just as the Europeans tried to play the tribes off against each other. And, you know, that what you understand is, you know, this is humanity, warts and all.
Well, you know, one of the things they talked, there was a government policy for a while about missionaries. They said, look, you just can't go into the interior and try to convert these people because you're making them sick,
mm-hmm.
because they're all dying of, you know, influenza and things like that. You just, you know, that was the biggest, that became sort of, people became very aware that was what was going on. It wasn't guns, in fact, it was germs.
Yeah.
Yeah. The missionaries actually give some great historical record. They might have been killing them in the process, but they have some great accounts of just that first meeting between, because the missionaries would go in and find a friendly tribe and kind of embed with them, and then they'd be there when they first met white Europeans, and like the natives were like, God, these people are filthy and ugly as hell, and really like the opposite of what you would what you've heard.
Sure.
But yeah, there it ends up just the role of germs really just kind of changed the course of history, right? I mean, we white Europeans have gone and tried to settle Africa and China, and those countries still look like Africans and Chinese people, but Native Americans are no longer here, and it's all white Europeans because of this plague.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. They used to call Africa the white man's graveyard because there are just so many diseases that the white man was not prepared for, and, you know.
You get weird shit going on.
Yeah.
Like in the Congo. Have fun.
Yeah. I mean, the Vikings tried to settle North America, they think, now, and they got their ass kicked because the Native Americans were badass warriors.
They were a fierce group. I mean, in the Great Lakes, they practiced cannibalism, and they were always fighting among each other. They weren't, and the Blackfeet and certain like certain Native populations, they were very big too. They weren't small people. They were tall and strong.
And I mean, there's a great book called Empire of the Summer Moon, which is all about the Comanche and how the Comanche adopted the horse. And just, I mean, you look at all of the tactics that the Comanche used in terms of horse warfare.
Yeah.
It's the same tactics that Genghis Khan and the Mongols came up with and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And if they'd had the horse, you know, a few centuries earlier, who knows what they might have done.
Yeah, technology.
Well, right, if they had the horse and just not all died off. And
yeah, exactly.
Been able to just be at full power. You know, there's accounts from right after Columbus came of European sailors, Portuguese sailors sailing up the East Coast, and they're like, it's so dense with bonfires, and you know, it's a fully populated country at that point. You they said you could smell the bonfires like a hundred miles out to sea. Like it was just there were lots of people here, and there still would have been if it weren't for the plague.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I like how you take JFK to task too.
Yeah. He was up to some shady stuff, and not just with his sexual exploits. He was
treated for gonorrhea. If you look at his medical records,
yeah,
he got himself in some trouble.
Oh well, yeah, he was. I think that's the more well-known side of his kind of darker side. But I don't think it's kind of ironic that we remember him for all these assassination conspiracies, because he was actively involved in planning and assassinating people while he was president. You know, he was always trying to assassinate Castro in ridiculous Wile E. Coyote ways. They tried to give him a poisonous cigar that would make his beard fall out, I think. He had just pulled the trigger on an assassination plot to kill the leader of the Southern Vietnamese, who were supposed to be his allies, but they were displeased with how things were going over there, and so that's the way you fire people when you're the president.
Just kill them.
And so, you know, that was happening right before he was assassinated. So
Do you buy into any of the conspiracy theory about JFK?
You know, I don't know well enough. I mean, I've read all the books, and I just still feel like it's as likely one way or likely that it was just this crazy guy who.
That's typically what assassins
wanted to be famous.
Yep.
Like both Oswald and then Ruby. Like, they were both kind of, like, people who wanted to be a big deal. And
I don't know much about Jack Ruby. What was he? What was his story?
He was, like, a kind of, like, the mob hated him.
Really?
Yeah, he was, like, kind of a joke, apparently, at the time. Oh. And, like, he had tried to, like, get involved with the mafia in Dallas. And they were
so
like,
sad.
Dude, you run your mouth too much. And, like, you are in it for the wrong reasons. Like, you just want to become... you want to become famous, and that's not where we generally like to keep things tight-lipped over on our side. So, like, this was a theory that I heard that I found pretty convincing last week on the anniversary of the assassination, was just the idea that, like, this was a guy who everybody knew in Dallas as, like, this guy who talked a big game and was, like, always talking about how he was going to be famous one day. And he saw his opportunity and just like took it
weird.
Shot Oswald. Like, well,
that makes total sense to me, man.
There was I don't remember what his name was, but the guy who shot Governor Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing because the guy wanted to shoot the president, like he wanted to shoot President Nixon. And then he realized that was going to be really hard. So then he worked his way down the list. He was like, oh, maybe I can get the vice president. And then eventually, you know, he figured out, oh, I can get Governor Wallace. And, you know, all he ended up doing was paralyzing him. But it was at first people were like, oh, this is motivated by, you know, the fact that Wallace is a racist and a segregationist and all that sort of stuff. No, just some asshole who wanted to be famous.
Yeah,
right.
I think Hinckley wanted to shoot De Niro at first, and then was like, I guess I'll settle for
Reagan.
Yeah.
Right.
It was just whatever he could do get on the news, because he was into Jodie Foster.
Which is understandable.
Right. Pretty lady.
You do some stuff on nutrition. We'll wrap this up soon. But you do some stuff on nutrition that is how people get fat. And I like a lot of the stuff that seems to you've talked to a lot of people. You have one thing I'll take you to task on is number of calories in, number of calories burned. In fact, what they're finding is it's the kind of calories you take in. You can take in a lot of calories and not gain a pound if your body isn't producing insulin. I just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, and we might be oversimplifying a little bit there. The main thing we're trying to combat there is this idea that, I don't know, types of calories, you should eat healthy foods.
Yeah, but I love that your health foods are trying to give you diabetes. I mean, a lot of health foods are high in bran and high in carbs and low in fat. That just spikes your insulin. That's not good for you.
Yeah. And they're also loaded with sugar. You know, exactly. That's the way that they make those ingredients palatable in a lot of cases, is they kind of have this sort of, if you just add the healthy ingredients, it makes up for the lard and butter and sugar that you're adding in there. But yeah, I think, and the other thing is just like this idea of like having a metabolism and like, eating at the right times of day, being
exactly
most important, you know, like this idea that you need this healthy, balanced breakfast at the beginning of the day,
right,
which includes toast, orange juice, milk, sugary cereal, like in the pictures that you see on TV.
Yeah,
and on
basically
the
spikes your insulin again and makes you fat and kills your energy.
Well, they've done a number of studies, and the only people who support the importance of breakfasts are the people who make Cookie Crisp.
Well, but not only that, I mean, you know, the idea of the modern American breakfast, that it should be the biggest meal of the day, I mean, that's marketing. I mean, that's something that's only 100 years old. People didn't used to have a very big breakfast. They used to just have like a cup of coffee and maybe a piece of toast or something like that.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, it was actually some guy who was some student of Freud's, who basically like came in and started marketing the bacon and eggs breakfast, the big breakfast. Yeah,
we actually covered that on the site, that bacon and eggs is like, I think it was part of, man, I'm forgetting it now, but it was a really brilliant marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to crack.com and read about it, but it was definitely, it was another one of these things that we only have as like sort of a piece of accepted wisdom because of brilliant PR.
Yeah, and that's what so much of this book is combating, is the brilliant PR and the myth-making, and just saying that, you know, what somebody has an agenda to sell, or what is the simplest, easiest story to sell, is not the truth.
Yeah, sometimes it's just to, you know, because kids ask a lot of questions, and so you just tell them something to get them
something
to shut
convenient
up.
To get them to shut up, to go the fuck
sometimes
to sleep.
It's that simple.
You got a thing here. The deaths caused each year in the U.S. Marijuana is basically none. Heroin is very small. Cocaine, very small. Prescription drugs is bigger than both heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. Alcohol is a lot bigger. Alcohol, including drunk driving, is even bigger. But really, by far and away, the deaths caused each year in the U.S. from substance are cigarettes.
Right. And that's the thing that, I don't know.
Tobacco is the killer.
It's just crazy that,
yeah, but
I mean, when you think back on your childhood and what your parents and teachers were, you know, the one acceptable drug was...
Was cigarettes, was the most,
the
most deadly.
Being out back smoking, it's like, and that kills, it's, yeah, we have a chart here and it just dwarfs the others. And, I mean, not the, obviously it's because they've done a good job of controlling some of the other ones, but it's just insane that can still happen.
Have you worked on getting this book to kids, to high schoolers and middle
schoolers? No, because we have a lot of F words in there.
I think kids could handle that shit.
Absolutely.
I think this is exactly what kids need to read.
Yeah.
And including with the F words. I mean, I don't want my daughter who's 5 reading it, I guess, but
yeah.
they're listen, when you're 15 years old, you've
heard
everything.
The F word.
Give me a fucking break.
And it's also, it's just a word.
Yeah.
You know.
I think it, there's a lot of our audience are high school and college age kids who, you know, we're still kind of big with those kids, and you know, we don't do a lot of marketing ourselves, so they kind of found us on their own and they feel cool about that. I think I'm happy with kind of that age group, and that's who we like to kind of think about when we're writing our articles, and you know, maybe the occasional very mature middle school student.
So if you're a middle school student and you're listening to this podcast,
right? Yeah, exactly. If you want your middle schooler to think you're super cool, buy this book for Christmas.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's a great gift both for yourself, and it's a great gift if you know kids and all that sort of stuff. Who can handle swearing?
Who can handle the truth, man?
You can't handle the truth, Jack O'Brien. You can't handle it.
Hey, Jack, said you were one of the greatest actors of our generation.
He is.
Proved me correct.
Jack, we got to hang. You got to come out to stand-up sometime. I don't know if you like to laugh, but I'll make you laugh. I got shows. By the way, I think I got shows. What am I doing? I'm at Helium. I don't know if you're going to be – I don't know when this episode drops, but I'll be at the Tempe Improv all December. Go to briancallen.com, for God's sake, if you want to laugh. Jack.
And although this may perhaps be a conflict of interest, we should mention that crack.com has their own podcast.
Does it really?
It does.
We do. We're about 11 episodes in. It's a weekly podcast.
I host it
with a couple of, and then I just like talk to some of the other writers on our team and just talk about the stuff like what we covered in this podcast.
Listen, man, I'll be tuning in. I love that stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to have you on at some point.
Yeah, there you go. Get Brian Callen on there.
Or Hunter Moss. Hunter Moss is actually smarter than I am.
No, don't.
No, 1941. I love it, man. Cracked. So it's called, what is the podcast called?
The Cracked Podcast.
There it is.
That's awesome.
It's through Earwolf.
I love it.
And also,
I actually like Crack. The Crack Podcast is a lot cooler sounding than the Brian Callen Show. God damn it. Joe Rogan made me call it the Brian Callen Show. I wanted to call it Man Thoughts or something, and instead it's fucking. Anyway.
Well, listen, I think Joe Rogan knows a thing or two about podcasting.
He does. You know, he might. He might.
Jack,
man, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, sir.
It was really great talking to you guys.
Yeah, it's a super fun book. Super fun book.
The book is at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the places that still sell books.
In a way, it should be the first book you read, ladies and gentlemen. You see that?
I appreciate it, Brian.
Not Guns and Germs and Steel, but Cracked, the D-Tex book. You're a good man, my friend. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Jack.
See you later.
All right. Bye.
He's a good man.
Good man.
And that was another great podcast from the number one podcast of all time.
That's true.
The Brian Callen, Hunter Motz podcast.
Well, it will be when we start getting dead people on. I really want to get on Plato, Aristotle, Albert Einstein, Isaac Newton.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll just get impersonators, shitty impersonators. I am Socrates, and I'm very smart.
Or we can get a psychic on and have the psychic channel. Yeah. You know, Socrates.
You know what's kind of funny about this book is that I knew a lot of this stuff just because I'm older and probably because, you know, you hear it and then you research it. And it's actually a fun book, man. It's really important to know the truth.
Absolutely. But that's what's so fun is. I mean, that's why I love books is this is 6 years of research by a team of guys and it's the best stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's just like. Great Google, you know, but you don't, I mean, like half the time, like would you know to Google, you know, the fact that ostriches are awesome? No, you wouldn't know to Google that. And that's the point. These guys have done a whole bunch of, you know, thousands of hours of work and put it into the tiniest
package
possible.
And by the way, I downloaded this book not from Audible, which is the first time on my from iTunes because it wasn't on Audible. I couldn't find it. And maybe it is. Hey, Apple. Hey, Apple, I can't read the books. I got to download it to my Kindle because this sucks. So fix, get better at making it easier for me to read books from iTunes. Okay, Apple, get better immediately.
Well, fortunately, I know that all of Apple does listen to the Brian Callen Show. So you can expect a response from Cupertino any minute.
Right. Later.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.